You're tuned to WFHB.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported,
community radio for South Central Indiana.
Good afternoon. Reporting remotely for WFHB, this is Benedict Jones.
And I'm Sydney Foreman. This is the WFHB local news for Friday, October 2nd, 2020.
Later in the program, WFHB correspondent Erin Comforti spoke with Katie Norris about her work at the Hotels for Homeless organization. That's coming up in today's feature reports.
Morgan County has, according to the CDC, has the highest rates of cancer in our state.
Also coming up in the next half hour, advocacy group Hoosier Action hosted a town hall featuring House District 60 candidates on contamination and health issues. But first, your local headlines.
Here is what you need to know today. WFHB correspondent Erin Comforti brings you today's local news briefs.
From WFHB, this is the local news brief for Friday, October 2nd. I'm Erin Comforti. Nearly 1,500 new cases of COVID-19 were reported in Indiana on Thursday, according to the Indiana State Department of Health. That is the state's record high, and it is 450 cases higher than the state's moving average. 13 new COVID-related deaths were added to the state's tally as well. There are almost 1,000 Hoosiers hospitalized because of COVID at this time. Locally, Monroe County saw 13 newly confirmed cases yesterday. That represents a significant drop in new cases since the middle of September. Surrounding counties saw between 0 and 15 new cases as well. Monroe County statistics do not appear to incorporate the vast majority, if any, of Indiana University's COVID-19 testing results, although county health officials say that they are in touch with the state health department and are trying to fix the reporting issue. Indiana University reported nearly 2,800 positive COVID-19 test results since mid-August. The university's website does not state how many of those positive tests belong to unique individuals. For the past 3 weeks, however, positivity has been trending downward across all testing categories at the university. The Herald Times is reporting that in its virtual meeting today, the Indiana University Board of Trustees voted to rename the Jordan River Jordan Avenue and Jordan Hall, all named after David Starr Jordan. Jordan was president of Indiana University and went on to become the founding president of Stanford. He was a well-known eugenicist. Eugenics is a racist junk science that supports white supremacist ideas. Jordan was an advocate of forced sterilization and deportations of non-white individuals. It is well documented that the Nazis took inspiration from the American eugenics movement. IU President Michael McRobbie recommended that the name change occur within a year from now. That's all for your local news brief from WFHB. I'm Erin Comforti.
Bloomington City Council discussed the 2021 Civil City budget for $166 million. During their September 30th meeting, Controller Jeff Underwood said the formal budgeting process was state mandated.
The state requires the types of forms that you have seen. You only vote on an app org that is the different funds that we have presented budgets out of. The opportunity for you there is a vote up or down. You can decrease as well any of those individual funds themselves. We're required to post 10 days in advance of the public hearing, which is tonight, on the Department of Government Finance a advertisement that advertises both the fund balances and the levies that go with that. So unfortunately, as we get into this part of it, it's very mandated by the state. We can't we can't alter from that process.
Underwood stated the council could vote for, against, or make cuts to the budget. He mentioned an increase in the general fund overall budget request.
In the general fund, the overall budget request is just over $48.5 million. This is an increase of about $1.8 million or 3.8%. When you factor in the $2 million for Recover Forward and a $194,000 decrease in property taxes, basically the general fund request this year was flat.
Underwood said the overall budget saw an approximately $4 million decrease, affected by a decrease in the food and beverage fund. Underwood said overall changes from the August hearing were a $17,000 total budget decrease and a $136,000 general fund decrease. Councilmember Isabel Piedmont-Smith expressed disappointment with changes.
There are no changes that reflect concerns of council members. The only change is because of Duke Energy increasing rates and a few adjustments of payroll because of you know, longevity, turnover and stuff like that. There's no change that was requested by any colleagues, as far as I know, certainly not those that were requested by me.
Piedmont Smith expressed frustration in administrative collaboration with the budget process. Councilmember Matt Flaherty said the budget worked around Mayor John Hamilton's priorities.
The budget as presented today is a representation solely of the mayor's vision and priorities. Zero changes were made between the budget hearings and now in response to council member concerns and requests. And nor do I, in addition to my colleagues, feel like our requests and our preferences and policy priorities as laid out in the budget advance meeting were taken seriously. I talked to most council members and I don't believe there was any follow-up from that meeting. There was no discussion of what it would mean to implement some of the things we talked about. And I don't feel like this budget reflects those, a lot of those priorities that were stated by council members. Mayor Hamilton has said that the city budget is the biggest and most important policy document the city has. And I agree. And a final yes or no vote is simply not an adequate level of input for the city's elected fiscal body.
Flaherty stated council members deserve meaningful collaboration. He expressed desire for built-in public engagement opportunities. Council member Stephen Volan expressed disappointment in policy initiatives from administration.
Seriously, though, and more importantly, I think the mayor should no longer assume that vague statements like "we have worked with council" are sufficient. I've made my primary concern clear, but across the board, there are concerns by a majority of members on a variety of topics. That a majority has even thought about voting no on the budget should give him pause, but it does not seem to have. This year, it's been a sobering education for me to learn just how limiting state law makes council authority over the act of appropriating money.
Volan said the administration should rework its council partnership. Council members recommended do pass on the budget. Council members Stephen Volan, Kate Rosenbarger, and Matt Flaherty voted no, while Sue Scambolieri and Isabel Piedmont-Smith abstained. Final budget approval will be held on October 14th.
On Wednesday, Hoosier Action hosted a town hall on contamination and health issues featuring State Representative Peggy Mayfield and House District 60 candidate Tiffany Grant. The town hall focused on the Superfund site at Pike and Mulberry Streets in Martinsville, a 38-acre contaminated site that causes potential health risks for Martinsville residents. House District 60 incumbent Peggy Mayfield, a Republican, said she is working on a more transparent public database when it comes to infrastructure.
The pressures of the pandemic and the impact on those have exposed our weaknesses. We're trying to respond to it faster. A lot of it using the CARES Act, and a lot of it will be through future legislation. As I mentioned, one of my priority bills will be to work on establishing some sort of database that is more user-friendly and accessible to the general public, more of a transparent and intuitive database. There's a lot of information that's going to be going into that, and that's what I've been working on.
Tiffany Grant, Democratic challenger for House District 60, discussed her background as a school teacher and how that informs her platform.
I am running for state office. Primarily, it was because of funding for public education. That was really the motivator behind my campaign. I want to provide better funding to schools, especially schools who serve students that come from less resourced areas. So those students who grow up in homes where they can't always afford school supplies, or they can't afford to participate in sports or extracurriculars because they just don't have that funding at home, or the parents' ability to transport them to events because they're working jobs or just don't have that access. So public education was really the primary motivator. But as I got going in the campaign, I added to that the need for access to affordable healthcare and mental health care. And I think that piece will be the most valuable to this conversation, being able to actually get medical help for everybody at a price point that we can afford on wages that are really low and in areas that aren't as served by hospitals as maybe they should be. I know in Martinsville, we lost our hospital. We gained a cancer center. You all know exactly why that is. And we need to provide better access to medical care all over Indiana, especially in the rural areas that we see in District 60.
Town Hall moderator Tasha Kopinger, Morgan County organizer with Hoosier Action, provided background on the Superfund site. She said Indiana is the second worst state in health risks from pollution.
Morgan County has, according to the CDC, has the highest rates of cancer in our state. There are four contaminated sites that we know of in Martinsville alone that are beneath people's homes. These contaminants have PCE and TCE, which are chemicals that are known to cause kidney cancer, non-Hodgkin lymphoma, cardiac effects, and bladder cancer. And there's evidence linking them to leukemia, liver cancer, multiple myeloma, rectal cancer, impaired immune system functions, various neurological and neurobehavioral effects, and severe generalized hypersensitivity skin disorder, as well as kind of being suspected of causing multiple other effects.
She said the water in the city of Martinsville is filtered through a process called carbon filtration, bringing the contamination levels down to where water is safe to drink. However, Kopinger states there is a larger concern for Morgan County residents that causes health risks through a process called vapor intrusion.
The larger concern that we have is in what is called vapor intrusion, which occurs when the water from the ground evaporates into the soil and can get into the air and people's homes. And with long-term exposure of people living there can cause any number of these health impacts that I just mentioned. And so we'll also say to anyone who kind of lives in Martinsville who may be watching, and also those on this call tonight, the EPA has recommended not to drink out of private well water until it's tested and confirmed to be safe.
Kopinger said the contamination disproportionately affects low-income residents and people of color.
And we are here because we know that all Hoosiers, no matter where we live, no matter the color of our skin, and no matter like what number is in our bank account, we deserve freedom to breathe clean air, to feel safe in our homes, and to play or to sit in our yards without fear of our soil being contaminated, and to know that our families are safe.
Marianne Schell, a 65-year-old Martinsville resident, asked Representative Peggy Mayfield how funding for the Indiana Department of Environmental Management is decided and where the money comes from.
Item funding comes from several different sources, including the general fund. It has permit fees, penalty fees, you know, there's 11 different special sources, licensing fees, and the expenditures of those, of that income, sometimes is designated to certain activities. So this is all available. It's part of the tax handbook. It's available on the IN.gov website. So you can look at, you know, it even gives the last 5 years of revenues based on these different taxes.
Okay.
Yeah, like on the air permit fees, it's actually reduced from $11 million to about 80, you know, 8, 8, million dollars over a five-year period. One of the possibilities is, because practices are improving the air quality, that there's less revenue coming in because there's fewer penalties being assessed. So it gives a pretty good explanation. But then the general fund is put together by the agency, and that would include things like payroll, personnel, IT, things like that. And they have to present their budgets to Ways and Means just like every other state agency.
The Environmental Protection Agency offered comments to the public through an online portal. You can access the submittal process at hoosieraction.org/cleanup. The deadline to submit a comment to the APA is Friday at midnight.
The Monroe County Library Board of Trustees selected a design plan for a new library branch at the Batchelor Middle School site. Financial Officer Gary Letelier said the design, including a parking garage, would cost approximately $1 million more than the all-surface parking option.
Our original plan was a $5 million construction bond and a $2 million general obligation bond. So if we go with option two, we can increase the general obligation bond from $2 to $3 million and stay within that 10-cent tax rate guideline.
Letelier said the debt level fits within the library's revenue increase plan. Director Marilyn Wood clarified a strategy is in place to cover the garage site plan option within the current tax rate. Architect Christina Matthew said the garage proved to best utilize the land gradient.
There is a drop from the west entry elevation to the east entry elevation of 15 feet in elevation. So we have to deal with that 15-foot grade change no matter what we do. And this is where the garage came in, because if we don't put the garage in, we're still going to have to backfill under the building 15 feet high at the east end. And then, of course, it would taper off as you moved west. But there was still a lot of effort, including retaining walls, all the things that go along with that grade change. So when we were looking at it, and we realized that the library would very much like to keep everything on one floor for lots of good reasons, operations-wise, security, all those things, we realized that if you entered from the top floor and kept everything on that floor, it made a perfectly wonderful opportunity to do what would be considered the most green thing you could do on site, which is to put the garage under the building.
Wood stated 44 covered parking spaces and additional surface lot spaces would be available. Matthew mentioned existing trees would provide a buffer between the middle school and the library. Wood said the elevator would provide access to the building's main floor from the garage.
And in fact, we considered whether or not we wanted to do that with an elevator, because there's an additional maintenance and just upkeep on it. But overall, felt like it offered a better opportunity and way to enter the building, as well as the amenity of having a covered area and a covered garage and the land use.
Board member Jamie Burkhart mentioned a garage could be utilized by the middle school as an off-site emergency evacuation location. Board members unanimously approved the library site plan with the parking garage. Now it's time for your feature report. WFHB correspondent Erin Comforty spoke with Katie Norris about her work at the Hotels for Homeless organization and a unique gift that the organization just received. For more on the story, we turn to Erin Comforty.
Katie Norris is Executive Director of Hotels for Homeless. Thanks so much for joining WFHB.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
So first off, can you tell us a little bit about the Hotels for Homeless organization?
Yes. So Hotels for Homeless is a low barrier housing first method to address the homeless situation in our community. So we find a family, we get a referral either from an individual or an agency here in town, and we go over some things with that family. We decide if they're a good fit for the program, and then we put them into a hotel. Once they're in a hotel, we get them food and all of the, you know, necessities that they need. And while they're there, we do a lot of casework to link them with other agencies and resources in town to see what all they need. And the end goal is to have them go directly from the hotel room to an apartment of their own.
Providing those resources to people experiencing homelessness requires resources, obviously. Where does Hotels for Homeless get the funding to provide those resources?
Well, it is almost completely community donations. So we do fundraisers and ask for community donations, mostly on Facebook. That's really where most of it comes from. We've had some amazing help from Anthem Healthcare. We just won a contest for a photo, and they donated $1,000. We won the Brawny Giant Award. They donated some money along with 600 rolls of paper towels. We have won a couple other small grants, and we actually just won the Trailblazer Award. This is the first time anybody will be hearing about that, actually. Haven't announced it yet.
Wow. Well, congratulations on all your awards and on the work that you're doing. And I understand that you received a special donation from the Eastman. Maybe you could tell us about that a little bit and give a little background on it.
Yes, this is personally the most exciting one for me. Kevin Eastman is one of the co-creators of the Ninja Turtles, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Cowabunga. So his wife, Courtney, reached out to us after finding out what we were doing and offered to send us some signed, autographed comic books. So she mailed them out. We've already done one raffle. Right now, there's a live auction going until Friday. We did an interview with them. Kevin Eastman himself actually stopped what he was doing and did a interview with Channel 13. So that was, wow, was pretty amazing a couple days ago.
Right. So you're able to auction off the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle special editions and get some good press as well.
Yes, absolutely. And they are all autographed by Kevin Eastman himself.
To get to the heart of the issue, this is about raising money to support people experiencing homelessness. And I'm curious how far funding goes. How much does it cost to give a person experiencing homelessness a hotel room?
So we have a deal with the Travelodge where we only pay $56 a night per room. So that means we can house a family of five or six. Right now we have a family with two adults and four children under the age of six, actually.
Wow.
Yes. So that is $56 a night for us to house six people, and they can safely isolate together. The parents are able to, you know, take showers and wear clean clothes and go to work. We help families who need help getting their kids, you know, to and from school. There's a school bus that will come directly to the hotel, pick up the children and take them to whatever school, you know, they are in at that time. They also have internet access at the hotel, so they can do online schooling if they choose.
Right. And how did Hotels for Homeless get started and your involvement with the organization?
Okay. So back in March, I personally knew a family who was homeless at the time. This was right when, you know, everybody became aware of, you know, just how dangerous the COVID-19 virus was. And the mother and two-year-old daughter were staying at a homeless shelter. The father was working and staying with another family member. Teenage daughter was staying with another family member, and the teenage son was staying with another family member. So this family was separated throughout the days, and then they would all come together. When the father would get his paycheck, they would buy a hotel room for a few days. They'd be buying fast food, you know, whatever they could, you know, get to eat in the hotel room, buy necessities, and his check would be gone in just a couple days. So they'd all be together for a few days, and then they'd all separate back out. And the mother and two-year-old daughter could not get into a shelter. The shelters had filled up one day. It was raining. They were desperate. They asked if they could come and spend the night with me. Well, I had chosen to isolate for myself and my children, and it completely broke my heart to tell them, no, you know, you can't come here. You've been exposed to, you know, many people at a shelter. You've been exposed to places at, you know, restaurants and the other family members who have been everywhere. I mean, the exposure was just exponential for this family. And so I got on the phone and I called every single place I could within like a 50-mile radius. I called every resource you can think of. And there was nowhere, nowhere that would take them, nowhere that could take them. You know, the resources are super limited and the need was just so great that I finally got on the phone with my dad, who is my hero and helps me whenever I have any sort of problem in life. He always knows what to do, you know. And I got a hold of my grandmother and my uncle, and the four of us kind of came together and decided that, you know, we need to set them up in a hotel and we need to, you know, pay for them to have a hotel long enough to where they can save up some of their paychecks so that they have a chance of ending this cycle of homelessness. So we had them in a hotel that night. My other family members had come together and ended up paying for 2 weeks. And I got on Monroe County Mutual Aid. And I said, look, there's this family. They're in a hotel. Can we please help them get some, you know, some food donated, necessities and everything so that they can, you know, have what they need and be comfortable in this hotel and save up their paychecks so that they can actually get an apartment of their own. Within the, you know, first day, there was food deliveries, toys delivered, you know, clothes for the kids. Somebody donated cash to them, just drove cash to them in a card with words of encouragement. And 16 days later, this family was in an apartment of their own. They are still in that apartment. During that 16-day period, there was a man who reached out on the mutual aid page on Facebook and said, I'm living in a hotel. My job is closed due to COVID, and I'm going to be homeless here soon if I can't pay for my hotel. Can I get some help paying for it? And I read it, and I made a post that basically said, look, I've got $10 on it. Who's with me? And by the end of the night, I had made an arrangement with the hotel, Travelodge, to where people could call in and donate however much they wanted. And by the end of that night, we had come together as a community and paid for 6 nights. So the next day I said, hey, let's do this.
Right. With the community coming together, those costs seem less cumbersome. Just a few dollars.
Yes, absolutely.
From everybody makes it a lot more affordable. Do you think that this model can scale up to meet the housing needs in Bloomington?
I think with the combination of all of the already amazing resources we have in town for the homeless population, that this can be a model that fills the gaps and help a lot of homeless families thrive. They can not only survive this pandemic and survive, you know, the episodic homelessness that they're experiencing, but they can thrive going forward.
All right. Well, Katie Norris, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with WFHB today, and thanks for all you do.
Well, thank you very much for your interest and support in this life-saving and life-changing program. I think the more we know about it and the more the community is aware of what we can do with this program, the more people we can help, and that's what we want to do. We want to help as many people as we can.
You've been listening to the WFHB Local News. Today's headlines were written by Aaron Comforti, Cade Young, and Sydney Forman in partnership with CATS, Community Access Television Services. Our feature was produced by Aaron Comforti.
Our theme music is provided by Mark Bingham and the Social Climbers. Our executive producer is Cade Young. For WFHB, I'm Sydney Forman.
And I'm Benedict Jones. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, listener-supported, independent local news program. You can hear tonight's full broadcast, as well as all other WFHB news programming online at WFHB.org.
You too can be a part of our award-winning news team. For more information about joining our volunteer team of citizen journalists, email news@WFHB.org.
Stay tuned for KiteLine. a program amplifying the voices of those within Indiana's prison system. That's coming up next on WFHB.